special news bulletin, the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
After the events of December 7th, 1941, the lives of Japanese Canadians changed forever. Over the next few years, Tadao Wakabayashi moved between three internment and work camps, Hastings Park in Vancouver, a camp in Salmon Arm, and one in Kamloops.
Upon reflection of, your experience during the war, would you say it was good, bad? How would you rate it? Like, do you kind of look down on it or as a bad experience?
No.
Why?
I think it was a good thing that ever happened.
That's Wakabayashi in an interview with Joanne Wood in 1983.
If it didn't happen, are we still down at the Paul Street? Are we still classified as a second-class citizen?
How could anyone consider that the events of the war were good for the Japanese Canadians, let alone a survivor? Between 1942 and 1948, 20,000 people of Japanese descent were forcibly removed from their homes along the west coast of British Columbia. They left their belongings behind, and in the years that followed, the government sold their homes, boats, cars, and personal effects without their consent, far below value. The impact of these events, material loss, cultural loss, psychological and physical trauma, has carried through the generations. There's no centralized Japanese community in Vancouver or anywhere on the West Coast. But still, Wakabayashi believes something good came out of it. When we talk about the internment and dispossession of Japanese Canadians in BC, we think of racism, discrimination, and hate. But today, we'll explore a different kind of story, one less often considered. We'll look at how Canadians of both Japanese and non-Japanese descent resisted the dispossession while it was happening and over time. Earlier, we listened to Tadao Wakabayashi's perspective. He looks at the period of internment and dispossession in a constructive light. He's not saying that these events themselves were good. He's saying that ultimately something positive came from them. It's not a familiar narrative, but we can see his perspective as a mark of resilience, a method of resistance in and of itself. Racism toward Japanese Canadians that underpinned the dispossession was not sudden. Around the year 1940, Hugh Keenlyside, an official from the Ministry of External Affairs, wrote a report called Japanese in Canada. In it, he states, quote, "Since the first Chinese and Japanese immigrants arrived on the Pacific coast of Canada, there have been periodic outbursts of anti-Oriental agitation," end quote. He means, of course, anti-Oriental agitation from European Canadians. Racism was prevalent, but it wasn't the only attitude. Keenlyside calls the pro-Oriental group of non-Japanese Canadians small, but they were vocal and public. In 1938, a charter amendment in Vancouver enabled discrimination against Japanese men who applied for fishing licenses, and in response, a Liberal member of the BC legislature, H.D.T. Perry, accused the city of having a philosophy similar to Hitler's. He wrote in the Vancouver Sun, quote, "If we struck out the word Asiatics and put in Hebraic, would we be doing the same thing by law as Hitler is doing in Germany? We allowed the Orientals to come here. Surely we're going to allow them some human rights," end quote. The comparison to fascist ideologies is common in newspaper opinion pieces from and about the early 1940s. Alarming headlines populate the pages, such as "Jap Canada status like Jew under Nazi" and "Is Canada becoming a police state?" These examples, even if there are many, tell us that before the war even started, non-Japanese Canadians did speak out against racist policies. Not everyone was complacent, and we can't assume that the public didn't know what was happening. We can't use ignorance as an excuse for this. These written records prove that the Euro-Canadian public knew exactly what was going on. After that restriction of fishing licenses, the one that Perry spoke against, sanctions against Japanese Canadians grew more severe. Mere days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, it became mandatory for anyone of Japanese descent to register with the Registrar of Enemy Aliens, no matter what their citizenship was. And then, over the next 2 months, Japanese Canadians were ordered from the coast. The Canadian Office of the Custodian of Enemy Property, a government institution established in 1914, took possession of homes, vehicles, and personal possessions. Under the War Measures Act, officers of the custodian had the authority seize and liquidate property that belonged to people classified as enemies. Not all government officials agreed with the policy. Dr. John E. Reed, the legal advisor for the Department of External Affairs, condemned the British Columbia Security Commission. The Security Commission was the government body established in early 1942 for the so-called protection of Japanese Canadians after Pearl Harbor. They were responsible for the removal of Japanese Canadians from the coast. Today, it can be hard for us to understand the logic behind the so-called evacuation and the subsequent dispossession. The government's often cited reason is security, that people of Japanese descent living on the coast posed a threat to the nation. In Reed's note, dated March 2, 1942, he makes it very clear that he isn't convinced by this argument. The taking of the property away from these men has nothing whatsoever to do with security, he says. So, what does it mean when an upper-level official explicitly states that, in his opinion, Japanese Canadians pose no threat? Well, it calls into question the government's reasoning and excuses. It shows that they had ulterior motives, more likely than not racially driven ones. Was the attack on Pearl Harbor, as one BC delegate said, a, quote, heaven-sent opportunity to rid themselves of the Japanese menace, end quote? Reed's statement shows that there was dissent around these policies within high-level government. Not everyone was satisfied with the actions taken. Reed laments that the transfer of property to the custodian, quote, strips Japanese Canadians of any cent they have in their pockets or in the banks. It takes the clothes off their backs and removes the tools of their trade, fountain pens from their pockets, books from their libraries, and hands them all over to the tender mercies of the custodian, end quote.
One such Japanese Canadian was Denkichi Machida, a business owner from Vancouver. He ran the Taiyo Printing Company and owned several buildings on Alexander Street. But all that was taken away from him, and he wrote a letter to the office of the custodians from the Tashmi internment camp southeast of Hope. The letter, typed on August 14, 1943, is striking. It's a document of resistance created directly at the time of dispossession. Machida is angry but articulate. His business has been seized. The buildings in his name, and his car, truck, printing equipment, and other possessions were sold after he'd repeatedly refused to sign consent forms. Then he writes, quote, "The other day I read in the News Herald the list of my printing equipments, which is to be auctioned off," end quote. He calls the amount that his buildings were sold for ridiculous, as in ridiculously low. He demands answers about the money the custodian received from the sales. He'd received some money, but the amount seemed far from what it should be. With the wartime law, Machida states, the custodian has, quote, "the rights to sell whatever I own without my consent, and on top of that, not let us know what they have done," end quote. Machida understands the law. He knows that the government's actions are technically legal, and he's determined that something be done to repair the injustice.
After all, when the dispossession started, the Department of Labor had promised that Japanese owners would get the money from the sale of their possessions. But in the end, the compensation was anything but fair, and the government showed an extreme lack of transparency in the process. Machida closes his letter with this, quote, "I'm keeping a copy of this letter, and if nothing can be done at present, I shall wait till after the war when I can produce this letter to help me win back what I lost and to voice what injustice has been brought upon us," end quote. We don't know if Machida fulfilled this promise, but we do know that after the war, he was far from the only person with complaints. As the war drew to a close in 1945, the Canadian government gave two options to Japanese internees. They could settle east of the Rockies or join the so-called repatriation program, which essentially meant deportation to Japan. Returning home to the coast of British Columbia was not an option. By August 1945, 6,884 Japanese Canadian people had signed for repatriation. Some of them were born in Canada and had never been to Japan. They got a sum of $200 per adult, but no specific compensation for what they'd lost as a result of dispossession. In 1946, Prime Minister King was bombarded by letters from repatriates. They all began the same way, quote, "I do herewith submit a claim for damage incurred as a result of coercive evacuation from the Pacific coast," end quote. The custodian had not kept its promise to safeguard seized property, the letter said. Use of language like coercive, sold at a loss, without consent, and forced sale clearly tells us that Japanese Canadians were not fooled by the government's euphemistic language of evacuation, relocation, or protection. Now that they had the power to protest, they did, in droves. In a personal letter to King, a man named George Tamaki enclosed a rundown of his family's losses, the difference between what their property was worth at the time of dispossession and the amount the government sold it for.
Tamaki's father and brother had been successful fishermen and farmers before the internment and had, quote, left behind them fairly large holdings of real and personal property which were later disposed of by your office of the custodian, end quote. All in, the loss amounted to $14,500, equivalent to about $250,000 today. Apart from the emotional and psychological pain that came as a result of forced removal and dispossession, the loss of material wealth, which for some families had been accumulating for generations, was immense. On January 24, 1947, almost a year and a half after the war had ended, Prime Minister King issued a statement that the government would compensate Japanese Canadians in cases where complainants could prove that the custodian sold their property below value. It sounds like a step in the right direction, but is it? A news bulletin from the Cooperative Committee on Japanese Canadians from May of 1947 points out that, quote, in the interval between the order for evacuation and the order giving control of property to the custodian, some goods had unaccountably disappeared, properties had deteriorated, and substantial losses had already been incurred, end quote. In other words, a narrow criteria that only looks at the actions of the custodian doesn't take into account other losses that happened before the custodian took possession of property. And putting the onus on Japanese Canadians to prove their losses is not going to allow justice to be served. The bulletin concludes, quote, the conscience of the people of Canada has been aroused in this manner, and the government would do well to grant generous compensation for all losses sustained during the evacuation, end quote. This bulletin shows that Japanese Canadians were continually critical of government action, that they worked to attain justice for a long time. They put pressure on the government from the time of dispossession, think of Machida's letter, until many years after the war. The Byrd Commission, a public inquiry into Japanese Canadian property loss as a result of internment, started later in 1947. The commission was established largely due to pressure and protests from Japanese Canadians and others opposed to the dispossession. In 1988, the Government of Canada formally acknowledged the injustice the Japanese Canadians went through during the forced removal, internment, and dispossession of the 1940s. The acknowledgement was part of an official redress settlement that also included $21,000 in compensation for each living internee, a community fund, and the establishment of a race relations foundation. It all happened because of a hard-fought 10-year campaign by the National Association of Japanese Canadians. This is where we return to Wakabayashi.
Wakabayashi's position is a complex one, and it could be interpreted in a multitude of ways. Our interpretation is that his view is a way to honor survivors of the internment era and their descendants. The immense obstacles that they faced mobilized resistance, not only in people of Japanese descent, but others as well. Intensely racist policies forced the status quo of anti-Orientalism to rise to a boiling point, become harsh enough for others to hear what Japanese Canadians had said all along, that they deserved equal treatment. Out of injustice, Japanese Canadians fought for their rights, their vote, their lost property, their dignity. Wakabayashi is saying, we didn't suffer for nothing. In 1937, Nellie McClung wrote an essay in protest of Japanese deportation, and she makes an observation that echoes Wakabayashi. Quote, progress follows a wavy line, like a fever chart, end quote.
And major, I still see the discrimination, but not as much.
Today we focused on resistance to dispossession, including resistance from non-Japanese Canadians. But that is to say, we don't mean to erase or understate how complicit many non-Japanese Canadians were, or that these events take place within the context of the ongoing dispossession of Indigenous peoples and their lands. This complicity and resistance both deserve attention. To acknowledge complicity can serve as a warning to present and future generations. This is what happens when you don't question the status quo. And to remember resistance can be an inspiration to people who are seeing injustice. It can be a source of strength for people who use stories to speak out. Thank you.